We talked last week a bit about what kind of circling around this question of like, what are our motivations in practice? What brings you to practice? What's your fuel going through practice? We've been on this exploration in a little bit of just some different ways for a few weeks, and it's a bit of a view teaching, really. And what that means is that in many of the systems of yogic contemplative practice, so Buddhist and Hindu yogas both, most of the systems around do this. In modern yoga and meditation, in a certain way, are exceptions to that, which I could speak to in an interesting way. They're an exception. But so many of the traditional systems start with giving you what to believe or a framework for the world. They say the world is like this. And if you accept that, then some specific conclusions are warranted. So, you know, in early Buddhism, very famously, the Buddha starts off by saying, it should be clear to everyone that suffering is part of this experience. Pain is part of this experience. And it's clear to everyone that we don't like that. You don't want it. And then he goes on into like, well, what are you going to do about that? But the first view piece, like the initial proposition in a mathematical or logical theorem, if you're going to lay out an argument, you have to start somewhere that's obvious and inarguable in a certain way. So the Buddha starts with pain because, you know, there's not that many people around who say that there's none of it. So from this thing that is obvious, then, and our biological response to that, not liking it, right? He starts from that and says, given that that's true, here's something you can do. And what you can do is he steps in and says, I promise you, it's actually possible to change your relationship to existence so radically that you actually are no longer suffering at all in relation to anything that's happening. That's a big claim. We talked last week or the week before, I think, a little bit how some of the modern systems and many modern, you know, Buddhists and yogis in some ways seem to have let go of what we could call believing in liberation, like thinking that there is such a thing even as full, complete, radical freedom from suffering, the end of suffering altogether. And that's interesting because it suggests then that we may have a different motivation for practice than, you know, the classical motivations, like the urge to be free from suffering, or the motivation that drove the Buddha and many of the early sages in the yogic systems, the urge to find a way of being that was not subject to death, and especially to repeated death, where the one of the foundational theorems is that this birth and death thing doesn't just happen once, but it's happening constantly all over the place in an endless cycle. And so then the experience of that being endless is painful in an endless kind of way. Therefore, you want to do something about it. So I want to talk a little bit tonight about how this idea, that's sort of the earliest Buddhist idea. There is suffering. It has a cause. It's possible to end suffering by uprooting the cause, and here's how you do it as an individual. That's the earliest layer or strata of the teachings. And then there arose this incredible mystical turning in Buddhism called the Mahayana, the great vehicle. And it arose some hundreds of years after the Buddha, a handful, It really got going by about the first century or so of the Common Era. And it flowers in this kind of wild body of texts called the Perfection of Wisdom texts that are extraordinary kind of dreamlike visionary texts, much, much more supernatural than the earlier texts that are really just the recordings of, you know, a human being walking from town to town teaching a very ordinary human kind of thing, for the most part. In the Mahayana texts, the Buddha is much more of a sort of semi-divine or divine force, not even really a being in a certain way. And the whole teaching can unfold, in almost like in dream space, in space where like to create the hall in which the teaching would unfold, the Buddha would emit, you know, rays of multicolored light from a tuft of hair between his eyebrows that would illuminate the entire cosmos and invite beings, bodhisattvas from all the various realms to assemble to hear teaching, and magically thrones and palaces would appear for them, thousands and millions of them, but the space would still not be exhausted. And it's like it goes on and on, pages and pages of like names of bodhisattvas and their great retinues and flowers raining from the sky and multicolored lights flying around, totally psychedelic stuff. And it's very likely that the practices that these sages were doing were not just the like intense mindfulness and concentration practices of the early period, but were also doing things like intense fasting and, you know, a practice that is still done in some Tibetan lineages, and I have friends that have done it. I've done mini versions of it myself, where you lock yourself in a pitch dark, sound sealed, light sealed space for many, many days at a time. The idea being that if you completely remove sensory impact from the outside and you're practicing very strongly with awareness, you will realize at a certain point that everything is created by your own mind. And this folds into, for instance, this is a side note, but this folds into, you know, we talked about a month ago or sometime, some Tibetan practices, for instance, of dream yoga, where you would first get good at lucid dreaming so that you can wake up within your dreams and really, you know, be volitional or conscious in your dreams. And then you would do that so much and with such clarity that you would begin to realize that this is a dream also. There's actually no distinction really between the waking dream and the sleep dream. And at a certain point, you're actually practicing with a continuity of awareness even through deep dreamless sleep, which is described simply as the experience of there being nothing to perceive. But you could be aware of that, which, you know, we'll just leave that hanging out there unless you have that particular skill. Hardly any of us do, but it can be developed. So all of this is sort of coming into being, and these texts appear that are essentially like psychedelic dream visions of the Dharma being spoken in this kind of cosmic way. But some very particular kind of earthly teachings or you know, not just psychedelic teachings came out of this movement. And one of them, in relation to motivation, is tremendously important in the Mahayana, almost the definition of the Mahayana as the great vehicle, meaning the vehicle to liberation that is not just about you as an individual. The definition of the Mahayana in terms of motivation is that your entire practice springs out of the feeling of altruism, of wanting to serve others. And this is both a natural feeling that I think, you know, human earthlings very often have or can get a glimmering of in the way that we are pack animals. Animalistically speaking, we're not cats, we're dogs, more or less. As far as we go, we do groups, and therefore understanding ourselves in as an identity that's more than just this body can come naturally. So these sages said, okay, well, what if the starting point of practice is not the wish for personal liberation, but the wish for the liberation of everyone? And this depends on a couple of things. And this is interesting. First of all, it depends on, from the beginning of practice, so not even as a result of deep practice, but as a starting point, being willing to feel that I'm intimately connected with every being that exists. And there's lots of different ways to do that. One of the most common, I'll say metaphors, but maybe it's actually just reality, that the Tibetans speak about, is to understand that if birth and death is cyclic and infinite, and that wakeful consciousness appears in beings and exchanges around in different ways and is passed from being to being in different ways, otherwise known as rebirth or samsara, endless churning. And if that's really endless, mathematically speaking, their conclusion, that you can accept or not, literally as you like, is that every single being, at some point in the infinite exchange of bodies, has been your mother, your father, your child, your spouse, your enemy, your friend. In other words, it's an interesting, wild vision of the cosmos that there's this like huge set or collection of bodies, ways to exist. And then there's consciousness that diversifies into all those forms. And that consciousness is kind of like sparks that just move around through the whole thing. You die and it arises somewhere else and it arises somewhere else based in your actions, but everything is interpenetrating. And it goes on for such a vast kind of infinite time length that you've been in every position thousands of times. You've been the king of the gods, and you've been, you know, a worm, you know, and everything in between. My teacher, Christopher Titmus, who's British, from Devon, and teaches in India half the year, every year since the early 70s, I did retreat with him there. And he was talking at one point about karma and reincarnation and the difficulty of once you get on a bad string of rebirths, it's very hard to kind of get out of a certain rut. You might know what that's like in your life, right? It's hard to jump out of a pattern once it's very embedded. The way that you get better rebirths is by acting ethically. But if you land in a type of birth where ethical action is not very easy to do, it's very hard to get out of there. So at one point he gave this whole sort of talk, and then he paused, and in his sort of South England drawl, which I cannot do, so I won't pretend to, he said, "You know, 10 million lifetimes as a mosquito." And of course he's saying this in Bodhgaya in India, in a Thai temple where it's the whine of the mosquitoes is a con, like everyone's got their scarves kind of over their heads, and it's just like, he says, you know, 10 million lifetimes as a mosquito. Because, you know, once you're in that cycle of like, that's what you do, you just bite and get smacked, and it's like, it's very hard to elevate from that. Side note, don't go there. But mostly you won't, hopefully. So this is one of the ways that within a tradition that takes for granted, for instance, the model of literal rebirth, this would be one of the ways to reflect on the path to liberation not being an individual thing, right? If you are already the consciousness that has been everything and is interpenetrated with everything relationally, and notice that the metaphor is related, it's family. Everyone has been your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your spouse, your child. And so you've been family with everyone, which means you essentially still are family with everyone, cosmically speaking. then it's not even just a shift of motivation to say, I will get enlightened for the sake of all. It's actually the only thing possible. Like, there's no individual left to get enlightened. And this is an amazing little, like, pull the rug out from under you, practice-wise, moment, because this vision where your motivation for practice would be to get liberated for the sake of others depends from the very beginning on you having a hit that you don't exist as an individual. In other words, the realization that is one of the culminations of the early practice, the realization of not self, is actually the starting point of Mahayana practice. You have to get an intuition, I'll say, or a felt sense that you are not alone as an isolated, suffering being before you can make this gesture that's considered to be the starting point for Mahayana practice, which is to long for liberation so that other beings will not have to suffer. And I think only in America do teachers really make a point of emphasizing that all beings includes you. I think we are the culture that hates ourselves the most, as far as I can tell. I don't know everybody, but we're famous for it, at least, in the Dharma world. And so many folks will be like, oh, well, you know, wishing for the well-being of others, like, I really just have to care for myself right now, which is appropriate. It's a healing gesture because our culture is so cruel toward individuals and gives right. No one comes out of the womb self-hating. It's taught, right? Like the old quote about racism, like, no one's born a racist. It's taught. All of those things are taught and learned very, very early, including the sense of self, including the sense of the insufficient self or the flawed self. And of course, it's taught quite literally. This isn't a mystery, right? I grew up in a religion that said, you are a sinner as soon as you were born. And you didn't do anything to deserve it. It's just the nature of things. Sorry, kid. Like, original sin. What a doctrine. So here's the pathway, then. Motivation for practice in this huge vision turns from individual suffering and the longing to be free from suffering into this, kind of through this intuitive spark that we're already not isolated. Therefore, if anything gets liberated, it all gets liberated. Right? It must be that when suffering departs from a stream of consciousness, the whole world changes. And then that can turn into what's formally called bodhicitta, or the mind citta of liberation or enlightenment, bodhi, wakefulness, which is sometimes defined as like the heartfelt longing to become fully awakened as soon as possible in order to have the most efficacious power of liberating others. In other words, I can do the most good in the world if I'm the most liberated possible. Therefore, because I care about beings and I want to stop hurting them through being deluded, etc., and I want to be able to serve in the biggest way possible, the best thing to do is to get enlightened as quickly as possible. And so the vow is, may I become a Buddha as quickly as possible in order to serve all beings. But the vow also at times becomes, I will remain in the realm of suffering. I will get as liberated as I possibly can, but I will remain. I will not dissolve into full cessation of separateness, really, individuality, because only by retaining the last thread of separateness, which is the quality of compassion itself. And we have to be separate in order for compassion to exist. Right? I don't feel compassionate toward you if we are dissolved into being one thing. There's just I think there's just love at that point, but in a not directional sort of way. So the bodhisattva, the one who's developed vast bodhicitta, the bodhisattva, the being devoted to liberation, in some models says, I will become liberated for the sake of everyone, and then I will continue in my perception of being interwoven with everyone until I have done the full work of liberating everyone. And this is vast. And so this is to be cultivated over, you know, tens of thousands of cosmic eons. In case you're having trouble with patience in your practice. It's interesting, right, that this idea comes, oh, I've realized that I'm not an isolated individual, therefore I can want to be liberated for the sake of all. But therefore I'm also not going to do, or I'm not going to hold the motivation to do what in the early system was the ideal, which was to fully extinguish the causes of suffering as soon as possible and just be completely released. Instead, which one can do in, you know, a relatively limited number of lifetimes. In other words, in the early system, in the Theravada system, say, it's, you know, you could become what's called an arahant, fully liberated, in this very lifetime. It's not, I'm going to say it's not that difficult. It's tremendously difficult. But there are some of them around, meaning it's not that difficult. It can be done. It is done regularly. But that's different from what the Mahayana system understands as being a full, sort of cosmically awakened Buddha field. So bodhicitta is the heart of motivation in the Mahayana. And it's a feeling. And much more than it's a different feeling than the feeling that motivated the earlier practice. Right? So there's this one layer, the individual layer, says, there is suffering. I suffer. I want to be free of that. Therefore, I will search for the cause of suffering, try to uproot that through practice, and realize the end of that cause, and therefore the end of the suffering. From that basic framework, and that's just the foundation, you have to do that. Because if you're confused about your individual self, and you just start spending all your time thinking about others, that's also not going to work, right? Haha. You have to liberate the individual, at least some, a substantial amount, before this cosmic radiating thing can stick. But once you've got a foundation that's solid in seeing through suffering and its causes, then you have the insight, oh, I'm not as separate as I think. One of the core insights you would get as you investigate suffering. And then it opens into bodhicitta. Oh, I am everyone. I'm connected to everyone. Therefore, what I want actually is not just for myself to be liberated, because that doesn't exist anymore as a separate thing. That same desire for freedom from suffering now kind of blows open to be the web that connects everyone. And there's this huge then, and depending on the strength of your essentially kind of feeling self or clarity and some concentration, that spreads in a pretty infinite way. So from the feeling that is the longing to be free from suffering, it turns into, through bodhicitta, altruism, the longing to relieve the suffering of others. With that as the basis then, so many of the foundational practices in Mahayana systems, like the Tibetan system and others, are practices that, like the mandala we did of saying, like, these are the layers of my identity. I identify with the body, I identify as a part of the family, I identify in community structures, I identify as part of a culture, I identify in ecosystem structures. All of that, in a certain way, is myself. Differently layered. Like that, and much more complex than that, the foundational practices then teach you how to think about the world. in order for this bodhicitta to grow. Right? So like, if you're not sure if you're really connected to everyone, here's a meditation. Think of everyone as your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, right? Like, okay, so you spend a while going around the world looking at everyone with that sort of veil or those particular glasses on. Like, oh, we're all related. Right? And that means that, like, some of you I like, some of you I don't like so much. I don't mean you. It's true, but I don't mean you. You know, that's always true. You just look at them and you're like, oh, right. Everyone's been everybody. And so, like, the little momentary preferences of this life are so tiny compared to, you know, the vastness of relation, of, you know, what our more local tradition here would call all my relations, right? So, you know, different practices would come, like visualizing mandalas that are extremely complex, much more complex than what we did. And, you know, using imagination, using words and description, one foundational practice is to visualize your refuge tree. So to think of your root teacher and then their teachers and their teachers and their teachers, and include the people that have been all of your wisdom beings and your families and everyone who's been a wholesome influence on you. And you make it into this vast tree with branches, and you try to keep everyone's picture in your mind all at once. Tremendous feat of memory and concentration. You need a lot of mindfulness to do this. And you just start with one. You're like, here I am, and then there's my teacher. And then there's my teacher and my parents. Can I hold them in my mind? And just, you hang out with that, and you breathe, and you concentrate, and you focus on it, and then you add more. And then there's that. There's that. And you could do this with your blood family tree or your teacher family tree. And you can do this with the mandala we did in the meditation. You can actually put individuals in each of those rings and try to remember them as you increase the rings. All of this is a way of saying that there's this theme at the center of all the Buddhist systems, both the individual-oriented systems and the everybody-oriented systems, that says that either as a liberating result of practice or as the very seed of liberating practice, we have to realize that we're not isolated individuals. And there's this term that's been around lately in other kinds of discourse, social action discourse, the term toxic individualism. And I like the adjective toxic in relation to it. There's a way that the culture here, particularly for lots of reasons, and some of them, you know, almost that toxic individualism is the shadow side of some very important liberations, right, that are beautiful and wholesome. Like, you know, individual human rights is a good thing, right? It's a good thing in cultures where we actually respect the rights of individuals, to want what you want, and to love who you want to love, and to do what you want to do, and to speak what you want to speak, and to pray the way you want to pray as an individual. And then, like, coming along with that, we have a culture that has actually stripped away fairly systematically all of the community structures that even 100 years ago held individuals. So the extended family has been dispersed. Communal bodies that were once, you know, very, you know, strong pillars, like church and other kinds of groups, have in many places, not all, but say around here, in something like progressive, secular, materialist, you know, postmodern culture, not groups of people as identity groupings, not holding the pillar. The role they once did. And in so many ways, through consumerism, etc., the idea that as an that your the part of your identity that is individual is actually the most important part of you, or in some ways you might believe this unconsciously is the only part of you. Like some of us really kind of believe that we don't really belong to our family or our communities or our culture or even the earth in a certain way. That I am a radically individual or isolated or separate being. And that ideology, that conception, I'll propose, is actually one of the most subtle and profound hindrances to liberation practice. That actually that conception, the shadow side of what we would call individual human rights, in many ways, the beauties of individuals, this is a shadow side of so many of the liberations that we've found over the last 100 years. But this shadow, because it depends for its, for what it does in the larger culture, it depends on solidifying the sense of isolation and separateness in us that gives rise to self-hatred and doubt and self-harming in so many ways. That actually this is a profound weight on the heart in relation to waking up. In some way we have to see beyond or bigger than that message. So I wonder if this is a place where these kinds of more vast or impersonal liberations are not impossible at all, but actually are just require a certain amount of deep healing for folks in cultures where toxic individualism is the primary message before their vastness can really take root. And I see this happening in senior students in my contemplative lineages before the big openings to the impersonal can really flower in a way that's wholesome and integratable. Something needs to be healed that goes out through all of those layers. Something in relation to the family and the community and the culture has to be healed, and our presence on the earth, so that we know that we're not separate. And then from that, then the heart can actually open. And until that's available, all of these practices will not be pointing to that vast emptiness, but instead will be slowly doing the work of healing, of basically assembling a sane, loving, non-self-hating self, which has to be there before anything else can happen. And then to begin to heal our relationships with family, with the community, with this culture, with the earth. And that process, I think, is our pathway toward this vast vision of interconnection that the Mahayana speaks toward. So your reflections, any thoughts and feelings here? Yeah, Lisa.
A little bit more about this tension between, you know, you have to, you're going to attain liberation in order to attain liberation for all beings.
Yeah.
But you're not going to, like, does it imply that no one's ever done that, or else we would not be suffering anymore, all of us, or, like
no.
How does that work?
Yeah. It works in a really mysterious way. Unfortunately, and this is one could use the word mystical for this layer of Buddhist teachings differently than the very kind of practical, you know, do this, deal with your mind kind of teachings that I mostly make my home in, because one of the mysteries of this bodhisattva save all beings thing is that you've already realized to some extent that the perception of separation of beings is itself only one layer. It's not even, it's not so much that it's, you know, some traditions would say it's totally an illusion. I don't say that. I hold difference to be real, but not absolute.
Right.
So, you know, it's real in the way that, you know, if you focus your lens on a blade of grass, it's a different blade of grass than the other blades of grass. But if you zoom out to the lawn, it's a lawn. It's one thing. And if you zoom out further,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. So difference is apparent in any given layer, but isn't an absolute identity. If you realize this, then, you know, if I think of us here in the room as a bunch of different beings who have our own sufferings, this would be a very straightforward, very simple kind of like, here we are individuals, here's some teachings, your suffering has causes, you grasp at things, you wish things were different than they are, stop it, that will help. There you go. Right? That's it, basically. What if I enter the kind of heart space where, first of all, I spend a lot of time, first of all, just loving all of y'all as suffering individuals. And I do that so much that the state of loving individuals, the feeling starts to predominate over the perception of individuals. Because suffering is fairly universal, seems like. Therefore, the kinds of sufferings that you each have as individuals are a little bit different, but not radically different. And so from a certain perspective, I can be like, oh, you know, I just care for all of these beings who, you know, who wish to not have pain and who wish to be safe and who long for connection and the feeling of whatever we could say. Individuality starts to drop away. And you could say, I'm experiencing this as an individual, but only from that layer. I would have to return to individual consciousness to experience that, and so would you. So we're all practicing.
Yeah.
Yeah? Any practitioner, here's the mystery, any practitioner who drops individuality entirely drops it for everyone. But, so anyone, you become a Buddha, it's all over. The entire universe is liberated. All beings are liberated. But I'm not liberated yet. You got liberated. From the perspective of individuals, you're done. But you're here teaching us. And you say to me the thing that all the sages say. You say, ha ha ha, don't you get it? It's all over. You're free already. And I say, I totally hear that. It's a great teaching. And I get a blast of kindness from you, but I'm still suffering. And you're like, I know. Let me give you some basic techniques. Right? So it's like you learn to zoom your camera way out and see the cosmos. I'm still clunking into blades of grass. You come down to the level of blades of grass, and you're like, yes, I'm an individual. I got enlightened. It's very nice. Let me teach you how to do it. And one of the things the early tradition recognized this, that it was a total paradox, right? It doesn't make logical sense. And so then they would give teachings that go literally like this. This is essentially a quote from the Diamond Sutra. It says, Bodhisattvas vow to save all beings. Bodhisattvas know that there's no such thing as beings. If a bodhisattva thinks that there is such a thing as beings to be saved, that's not a bodhisattva. Right? Therefore, bodhisattvas save all beings. Right? A different way to say that is in the great vow that we would chant at the end of the morning ritual in my first Zen monastery. So I'll tell you what the vow is, which is there's these four great vows, of which one of them is, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Right? So you start off by stating the infinite. There's infinite number of beings. I vow to save them. It's completely impossible. As long as there's an I cannot do that. That's the great vow, right? And it puts you in this spot of paradox where you can't solve it. So that's one hint, is that, like, yeah, as individuals, you get enlightened, and it doesn't till tomorrow. So for a day, you're in different states. But from the enlightened perspective, everything is over. And from that perspective, and this is part of the mystical part, everything has always been over for everyone, even though they don't quite know it. That's the strange part. Is like, oh, because enlightenment isn't dramatically different from ordinary life. But I mean, the descriptions are dramatically different, but why is it that all the sages, so many of the sages, they say, like, when the Buddha got enlightened, he said, the thing I've just discovered is so subtle that no one will believe me. Right? And other sages say things like in the Tibetan tradition that I'm doing a little bit of referring to tonight and recently, they'll say things like, the nature of your mind is not different from the most ordinary mind. Or Zen would say, ordinary mind is the way. There's nothing special about being liberated from the perspective of liberation. From the perspective of non-liberation, it's tremendously special to not be suffering. And you're supposed to want it with all of your fiber of your being. But from the perspective of liberation, it's, you know, the early metaphor was like, when you blow a candle out, where did the flame go? Do you long for it back? Like, it's just cooler. It's just cooled down. It doesn't hurt any. It doesn't burn anymore. That's it. It's the only thing that's changed, is the pain is gone. So all of that is, is a way of saying that there's, these sages realize that if you have that not-self insight that the early teaching was really pointing toward, you have to realize that you're interwoven with the whole thing. If you really have that, every structure of identity breaks down. Everything about who we think we are in every layer breaks down, because it's all dependent on the perception of the individual separate self. So if you lose that, there's no way to describe what it feels like without that, without believing that. You know, as soon as you recognize that the individual self is a costume that you pulled out of a kid's costume trunk in order to play a role for a little while, and you can just drop it as soon as you don't want to be the pirate anymore. That you never were a pirate. It's just a costume that played a role in the drama. Like, there's no way to convince a pirate that they're actually not a pirate. Like, you just have to wake up. And then you're like, ha! You know, and some of them will just start laughing. A very common experience after this kind of, is just laughing. So that's something. Really, you're absolutely right in saying this. It makes no sense from the perspective of separation. And then I'll just propose that you're not even supposed to understand this cognitively, although in Zen you're supposed to chew on it. The teaching says, as if you swallowed a hot iron ball and you can neither spit it up nor swallow it down. Hold on to this paradox and don't let it go until it breaks through. That's one style of practice, very Japanese style of practice. Did that for a while.
Does Zen fall under the Mahayana tradition?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And even sort of veers into the tantric a little bit, although they don't use the word. But I'll say, also in terms of practice, that, you know, it's one thing to say, like, here's the great vow, you know, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Okay, that's a great paradox. Chew on that. Hold it in your body. And the moment that vow appears in the ceremony is not random. Like, you know, this is an energetic practice. So you chant that vow after a full... So you've woken up at 3. You have 10 minutes to get your robe on and get into the zendo and be sitting sternly upright before the clappers hit, the incense is lit, the flower, and the bowing, and then there's There's running to the Dharma hall and assembling. There's a quick tea ceremony in the hall. And then there's running to the Dharma hall, assembling in long rows. And then an hour in dim light of someone hitting a huge drum that's basically a wooden slit drum carved like a ginormous fish. And it goes, dum, 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 about that fast. And the chanting is guttural, and it's steady Sino-Japanese syllables. It's not even really functional modern Japanese. No one really knows what it means. But it's these ancient sutras that are not even teachings as much as magic spells. And it sounds a little bit like this. You have to imagine the drum. It's 3:30 a.m. You are tired. And but you're sitting there. You're kneeling, really. And the chanting is this. For an hour, you're just reading pages of syllables until you've memorized them. And then after all of this, and it goes on and on, there's candles and incense. It's a deep, ancient religious ceremony. And you're in a pretty trancy kind of state after about an hour of that. And then, you know, all these different chants, you chant to dead ancestors and you invoke emptiness and you invoke deities that guide you along the way. And at the end of the whole thing, it falls silent and the drum goes, for the first time, it slows down and you chant the great vows. It's these like short sentences. It's just like slow. And at one monastery I was at, you chant them, and at the end, they just kill the lights. And it's about 4:30, and everyone just bows, and you're just like, you know. And it's like, okay, I'm singing this kind of crazy paradox, but what I'm actually doing is I'm doing an old, earthy, shamanic practice, right? We're doing a steady beat on a gigantic fish drum. And we're singing this at 3 a.m. So there's that too, that like at a certain point, many of these practices in their early incarnations, and I'm trying to figure out ways to build this into our contemporary practice without being completely artificial, because my culture didn't teach this to me. But they all become ecosystem practices at a certain point. Like before you even get the teaching on how radically empty it is in some of the Tibetan traditions, you know, I sat through an initiation where I was supposed to sit in full lotus for 2.5 hours because you have to keep your spine upright in this way. No one did it because none of us can. Some of us tried. It hurt a lot. But like the teacher was like telling us like, oh, hey, this is what's going to be. We're going to teach you the nature of the mind. But first, I have to say this magic spell over this bowl of water, and he would give it to one of the teachers and say, go, you know, go out and throw this into the creek to the west and come back. And as well, go and throw this on the hillside to the north. And actually like cast directions and offer water to the spirits. And that's what this thing was held within also. So all of that is really like, again, that layer of practice is a medicine for toxic individualism also. Like, don't even think about the problem of individuals and getting liberated, but like, enter your trance deep in the nighttime and like, have a relationship with the creek and the mountainside and do this ritual, and you'll understand it in a different way. So, something like that. Yeah? Thanks for asking.
That was a great answer.
One tries to speak to that layer of things. So as we go on from here, and first of all to say that I'll have a sub next week because I've been asked to come down to Insight Meditation South Bay and give a talk down there. And it's a pleasure to be asked and to do so, and it's just a bummer that it's on the same night as this. So someone else will come and give you good dharma, probably not chanting. next week, and I'll be back the following week. And we'll continue, I'm going to continue talking around some of these core concepts of the Mahayana, partly preparing to record this, a commentary on the Heart Sutra for a course a little later this spring. So fleshing out some of those ideas. And I want us to chew on it, especially because this was the layer of Buddhist practice that really was designed to address the kind of suffering that we are in as lay people, as non-monks and nuns, as folks embedded in the complexity of relationship who don't have that much time to practice. These practices were actually designed to meet that experience. So we'll continue in that direction as we go on. Close with just a blessing to remind us again to, whenever we remember to do so, to relax our sense of ourselves, really just relaxing the body, relaxing the mind as much as we can, and just not trying to get rid of the sense of self, but just trying to expand our capacity to remember or to be mindful of the connections that are there, to remember the family and our place in it, to remember our communities, beloved community, and our place in it, to remember that we exist within the great scaffolding of cultures, and that everything that we are is absolutely inseparable from the ecosystem. That we are that ecosystem, we are the consciousness of that vast system. As we remember our interconnection, may the mind of liberation arise. May we, together with everyone, awaken fully. So, thank you so much. Pleasure to be here. See you soon. Yeah, take care. Again, Colombian caramels, they are not unsweet, but really quite good. You can keep the chant sheets for home practice or bring them back as you like. Thank you so much. Yeah.